The Tom Woods Show, episode 505.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Inbox Dollars pays you for playing online games, for taking surveys, for searching the web, even for redeeming coupons. Get a $5 sign-up bonus when you join through tomwoods.com/inbox. Code School can teach you a highly marketable skill, web technologies, in your spare time, cheaply, and you'll feel like you're playing a game instead of sitting in a classroom. Get your free account through tomwoods.com/code. Welcome, welcome, welcome to episode 505. I'm talking about history again. I can't stop myself. Actually, this is a conversation I had with Richard Emmons of the Ron Paul Homeschooling Podcast. Here I'm going to take history from 1493 up to the present in the next hour. Actually, I'm going to let him feed me topics, and I am going to give you some history. We're going to be talking about, well, everything from the Protestant Reformation to the English Civil War to early libertarian thought to the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the Reign of Terror, the Industrial Revolution, and that's just to get things started. So make sure you listen through to the whole thing. Eventually, we're going to get somewhere near the present. And we're going to be talking in particular about my course for the Ron Paul curriculum, which is, the one we're talking about today is Western Civilization from 1493. And if this episode piques your interest in that course, on today's show notes page, tomwoods.com/505, I will show you the three ways to get that course. You can get it on its own at tomwoodshomeschool.com. You can get it as part of the Ron Paul curriculum at ronpaulhomeschool.com. Or you can get it as a gold or platinum level supporter of the show at supportinglisteners.com. I'll have all those links up at tomwoods.com/505. Of course, don't even consider joining the Ron Paul curriculum except through my link, ronpaulhomeschool.com, where you get $140 worth of free bonuses. That package is not available anywhere else. Of course, check out the Ron Paul Homeschooling Podcast at ronpaulhomeschooling.com. All right, here we go with my conversation with Richard Emmons.
Well, it's great to talk to you some more about Western civilization. There's a lot that we can talk about today. We've already covered all the way through 1492 in an earlier episode. And I noticed that lesson number two of this course is a review of Western Civ to 1492. So you do that for the students as well.
And so all people really have to do is listen to your podcast and they'll get that review.
That's right. If it was only so easy, if it was only so easy. Well, that's great. Well, this is a great course because it leads us, beginning in 1493 and so much history that's happened over the last 500 years around the world and how it impacts us today. And we're going to be going over kind of in a big picture, some of the major periods of each of the five centuries that you cover. But why don't you start out and just talk about the lectures and the reading assignments and the writing assignments and how you tie them all together to help the students learn the material.
Well, it is organized the way I've arranged all the courses I've done for the Ron Paul curriculum. We've had episodes now on the two Western Civ courses that I've done, and then also I have Government 1B. And I have tried to be consistent across these courses in which I'll have a reading assignment every day with occasional exception. I just couldn't find anything that was any good. So I'd say, don't read anything. Just listen to me today. But by and large, a reading assignment every day and then a writing assignment each fifth day. So assuming they're doing it Monday through Friday, Friday is the writing day. So on Friday, I will have a review lesson where people are not learning anything new. They are simply going over what we've done during the week, and they're getting that material solidified in their minds, so it's not just a bunch of facts thrown at them that they'll never remember ever again. And the reading assignments get them accustomed to reading rigorous secondary sources as well as some, well-chosen primary sources so they can engage with the historical actors themselves. That's not always so easy. Sometimes the people I want to talk about, their writings are much too difficult for
a lot of students at this age, but I did my best. So it gets them accustomed to that. And then the writing assignment every single week gets the students used to the practice of writing frequently. And of course, a lot of students have taken us up on the suggestion that they start their own blog and they publish their essays that they're writing every week for me on that blog. Now, of course, parents don't have to require that. Parents can forbid that if they like. It's up to them. But this gives them an opportunity to get their writing read by others. I mean, their blogs might not be the most trafficked in the history of the world, but it gives them practice in writing for the public and in blogging and knowing how WordPress works. So it gives them a little bit of a leg up over virtually all of their peers. So that's the way it's organized. Reading assignment every day, you watch the accompanying video, and then you've got that writing assignment every single Friday. So by the end of this course, you will have gone from the Protestant Reformation all the way up through the present day, really. I mean, certainly up through the turn of the millennium. And then we've kept the last 3 weeks of the course open. So instead of 180 videos, this one's 165. I almost said only 165, but I can't bring myself to put the word only in front of 165. But we do it that way partly so that the last 3 weeks can be devoted to a term paper, but also so that as events unfold in the world and history marches on, we'll have some space to insert some more lessons in the future.
Hey, well, that's great. You're really thinking ahead on the planning of this course. That's excellent. Why don't we start out and talk just a moment about the Gutenberg Press and how that shaped what happened after it. You spoke about the students starting their own blogs, and that's really the modern day equivalent of the new technology on how to publish. But back in Gutenberg's day, it was the printing press.
Well, that's right. And of course, the primary immediate influence of it that we see has to do with the Protestant Reformation. Because here you have people who are challenging the most influential institution in Western civilization, the Catholic Church, and they are able to circulate substantial numbers of copies of their literature. And that literature spreads very quickly. And it has a tremendous effect, practical effect on history. A lot of times students want to know, why does this matter or why should I care? What difference did this make? Well, there are a million reasons that that Gutenberg matters to history, but I can give you a super specific, semi-immediate one, and that is that the Protestant Reformation was able to spread its ideas extremely rapidly and effectively. In fact, so much so that the Catholic clergy was frankly not prepared to deal with it. The seminary system that we have today, in which priests are trained in a formal setting, did not exist at that time. It came about as one of the reforms after the Council of Trent. And very often, a lot of these priests were miserably educated. And so here they are with these criticisms of their beliefs coming at them from a biblical perspective. They haven't got the slightest idea how to cope with them. And perhaps in the past they wouldn't have had to cope with them. But now they're faced with this well-organized movement that is backed up by the ability to spread ideas more rapidly and effectively than had ever been seen in the world up to that time. Now today, of course, with the technology we have now, by comparison, Gutenberg looks like a lazy bum. But certainly by those standards, it was a world-changing development.
It was a world-changing development, and didn't that cause an increase in the desire for literacy?
Well, of course, if books are going to be available to you, then you're going to be more likely to want to read. And that was one of the issues, of course, when we look back at literacy figures during the period of Western civilization from the birth of Christ to now. Of course, most people are not literate, but that wasn't necessarily because they didn't care about education. First of all, most of them are just trying to eke out some kind of bare material existence. But also, there's no real reason to read when books are prohibitively expensive and everybody's got to copy them by hand. And if there's a Bible, it's chained down. And people sometimes interpreted this as the church didn't want people reading them. It's that, you have any idea how much work it took to copy over an entire Bible? You cannot let that thing get away. So, yeah, now suddenly it becomes possible, and as the centuries go on, it even becomes possible for some authors to make a living writing books, which just would have been impossible to imagine before that.
Absolutely. And one of the most prolific writers of the time was John Calvin. And why don't you talk about him and the impact that he had?
Calvin is going to systematize the ideas of Protestantism. Now, Protestantism differs among itself. I mean, that is to say, there are thinkers like Luther and Calvin have disagreements with one another. Luther and even his own friend Melanchthon had some, at least, strategic disagreements. Luther and Zwingli had major disagreements. But there were some things that they could agree on. Certainly, they could roughly agree on the idea of sola scriptura. They could agree that the papacy was an unbiblical abomination. They could agree that the laity ought to be reading the Bible. So there were a number of ideas that they definitely shared in common. But Luther was not a systematizer. He wrote a whole bunch of he wrote a lot of correspondence. He wrote a lot of criticisms of individual people. He wrote the small catechism, the large catechism. He wrote treatises on various subjects, on the will, and so on. But he never really wrote the systematic, chapter by chapter, step by step Lutheran position. You can find, I think, the set of Luther's writings in English takes up about 45 volumes. So there was no shortage of writing, but there's no one place for people to look to. Calvin supplied that deficiency for the Protestants. He produces the Institutes of the Christian Religion. And this is going to give you exactly what at least his version of the Protestant view holds systematically, so that they can say, we're not just nitpicking, we're not just taking apart this argument that the Catholics have and that one. We are systematically presenting an alternative in every single aspect of the Christian faith. We're showing where we stand. That basically made the Protestant movement intellectually fulfilled. So that's the primary significance of Calvin in history.
Excellent. And there was all the wars in Germany, but they also had a lot going on in England during this time. What happened in England that we can talk about?
Well, we can either there are two different periods we can think about in England. We can talk about either the Protestant Reformation in England, in which there were some uprisings, or we can talk about the English Civil War.
How about the English Civil War?
The English Civil War, now we're at the 1640s, and here we have two different groups who are at each other's throats. We have King Charles I, who was thought of as somebody who wanted to rule without the influence of Parliament. He wanted to rule on his own. And then you had the parliamentarians who were fighting against him, the parliamentary forces, who believed that Charles was an instrument of royal absolutism, or would-be royal absolutism in England. And the result was the English Civil War that ended with the actual execution of Charles I in 1649. This is interesting to note for a number of reasons. One of them is that Edmund Burke was a much later British writer in the late 18th century. And one of the areas in which he favorably contrasted England with France at the time of the French Revolution was to say that in England, sure, sometimes changes have been necessary, but we've carried them out slowly and gradually in a conservative sort of way. Whereas in France, you have this upheaval where everything's on the table and everything's being changed, and this is a tremendous social disturbance, and it's not going to end well. But what Burke neglects in his story is this period of the 1640s. This seems like rather a bit of an upheaval and a bit of a disturbance. The actual execution of the king, there's nothing in the law that allows for that. So England had its own periods of disturbance, just like France, as it turns out, but perhaps not as extensive. The other significance of the English Civil War for libertarians would be that this is where we begin to see a full-fledged, fully developed, or at least the beginnings of a fully developed idea of natural rights in a libertarian way. And that's at the hands of a group of people in the 1640s known as the Levelers, who believed not in communism, they didn't believe in leveling in that way, but leveling in the sense that everybody's got the same rights. And they had this sense of the idea of self-ownership and rights to private property and rights to the integrity of your own person and so on. And that began to be spread under the pressure of the English Civil War. So that's a significant episode in Western intellectual history that comes out of this period.
Excellent. That's something that we benefit from today, something that happened several hundred years ago. Very good. Why don't we move on to Russia? You know, Russia's in the news today with Putin and everything that's going on there. Why don't you spend a minute and talk about Peter the Great? What was so great about him?
Well, great in the sense of significant, as a lot of these people who are called the Great sometimes are. Sometimes they really are great, like Gregory the Great, for example, was I think, great. But Alexander the Great kind of depends on your perspective, I suppose. Peter the Great, in terms of a value judgment in calling him great in the colloquial sense, a lot of Russians would have disagreed with that, but some of them would have accepted it. His view was that that Russia needs to be modernized, that we need it to be modernized so that it can be like the Western European powers. That involves also modernizing the military. His view was that the Russian military was outmoded and backward. We need Western industry. We need some of the enlightened Western ideas over in Russia. So, of course, for people who are entirely forward-looking, they might say, well, this is a tremendous personality, and he's going to bring about a lot of good in Russia. But for those who are more traditional in their outlook, they viewed Peter the Great as really a quite outrageous figure, who at one time, more or less, I already said in the previous episode that in the Orthodox East, you have a kind of promiscuous relationship between the emperor and the church. The emperor is really dominant over it, but Peter the Great, if anything, took that to an even greater extreme. He would have no patience whatsoever with the old believers in Russia, for example, who objected to a fairly minor liturgical change in the Orthodox liturgy, but they considered this like a life or death matter, and he thought this is the typical example of this backward country I live in, and I'm trying to bring them some enlightenment. So his thinking was, I want to go and see the West and see what I find. I want to bring as much of this ingenuity and know-how back to Russia as I can and try and give Russia try and push it into the modern world and not really worry about the resistance of people who have older ideas. Those people are going to have to just give way to the new Russia.
Well, another person later on, Adam Smith, also wanted to do away with old ideas, and he wrote prolifically and has had a huge impact on us in terms of free trade. Why don't you talk about Adam Smith?
Adam Smith, so here we're still in the 18th century, was a writer whose primary work, or work that's known the best today anyway, in addition to his theory of moral sentiments, which is gaining a bit of having a bit of a renaissance right now, is The Wealth of Nations. That's a short version of a very long title. And Smith was of the belief that the reigning economic idea of his day, or at least that was reigning in certain political circles, was all wrong, and that was mercantilism. And there were all kinds of wrong-headed views that constituted mercantilism. But certainly one of them was that they were not altogether in favor of free trade. They thought that we should, if not aim for national self-sufficiency, then we certainly shouldn't go out of our way to encourage free trade. They thought that real wealth amounted to accumulating precious metals. But from Smith's point of view, real wealth means, well, what kind of standard of living do the people enjoy? Not how much unspendable currency can you pile up, but what is the standard of living of the average person? And he began to show the merits of having free exchange in the same way that it would be ridiculous for me to say, I only want to engage in trade with other people in my town. And if anybody in my town is selling me something that was made in another town, then I don't want to buy it. I'm just going to have just my town only. If that were true, 90% of the things I might want to buy, I couldn't buy at all. And there's no way you'd be able to convince me that I'd made myself better off by this policy. I've obviously made myself worse off by cutting myself off from what the world has to offer. And his point was that the world has an awful lot to offer. And then later thinkers like David Ricardo and then Ludwig von Mises especially would say that certain countries specialize in certain things. So it's better to have them specialize in something we specialize in something, and then we each produce more than we would have if we had tried to be good at both things, and we just trade our excess, and we exert less energy, and we get more stuff to show for it. And Ludwig von Mises in the 20th century took this to its logical conclusion and said this is true even of individuals. Imagine you have an individual who is better than everybody in town at, let's say he's the best doctor in town, but he's also a better secretary than all the secretaries, and he's a better office cleaner than all the office cleaners, or he's a better accountant than all the accountants. Does that mean that he should keep his own books, clean his own office, and do his own correspondence? It doesn't, because he's so much better of a doctor than all the secretaries are, and so much better of a doctor than all the accountants are, that he should specialize in being a doctor and take the excess that he earns as a doctor and pay somebody else to do all this other work for him. And so even when you are better than everybody else at everything, you still need those people, because it's better for you to specialize in the thing that you are ridiculously better at so that you can earn the absolute most you can earn. And meanwhile, if I wanted to hire the best doctor in town to be my office cleaner or my secretary, I mean, how much would he charge me? $10,000, $20,000, $30,000? I mean, well, I'm exaggerating. I mean, he'd have to be a really fantastic doctor. But the point is that I would be taking him away from an occupation where he could earn so much that he would have to earn a ridiculous salary as a secretary, and no one would want to hire him. So it goes to show that even an average secretary can outcompete the best secretary in town in a case like this, because he's better off being a doctor. Because if he tries to apply for a job as secretary, he'd have to ask for such an outrageous salary to compensate him for drawing him out of his medical profession that everybody else who's applying for the job would be more competitive than he is. So we can all fit in. There's a place for all of us. Whether we're great at everything or whether we're not so great, there is some place that can be found for us somewhere in the economy.
Absolutely. It's just the division of labor doesn't divide us, but it ultimately unites us because it makes us all better off.
That's right.
Now, where did Adam Smith come from?
He was from Scotland.
So why is that important?
Well, Scotland is one of the countries that we associate most closely with the Enlightenment of the 18th century. Now, the Enlightenment spread throughout Western Europe, but we think primarily, or at least I do, of the French Enlightenment and the Scottish Enlightenment, primarily simply because they produced so many writers and so many thinkers. And we sometimes contrast the French with the Scottish Enlightenment because you have a lot of Presbyterians involved in the Scottish Enlightenment, whereas you don't really have that in the French Enlightenment. The French Enlightenment was this, and when I say Enlightenment, I'm talking about an intellectual movement, a period of history in the 18th century, in which there was an attempt to take all customary practices and hold them up to scrutiny. So we've been arranging the economy in such and such way for a long time. Does that mean it's the right way? Or we've believed such and such about religion for a long time. Does that make it right? Or we've arranged our political organization, our political institutions in such and such a way for a really long time. But does the fact that something is hallowed by tradition, does that make it right? And so they began to examine everything over again. The Scottish Enlightenment is typically viewed by historians as having been somewhat more moderate than the French Enlightenment. There wasn't the anti-clerical, anti-religious spin to it, although you see a bit of that in David Hume. Whereas in France, there is a much more open assault on the inherited Christianity and Catholicism in particular of France. But in both cases, both Scotland and France, there is a respect for the market economy. And it was thought that what had preceded the market economy was the classic example of an institution that's been around a long time or practices that have been around a long time, and namely, in this case, the practice of the wealthy and influential game the system to increase their wealth at the expense of everybody else. And they thought that the market economy was a great answer to that because it doesn't privilege anybody. It lets everybody exchange freely, enter into contracts freely, and choose their own destiny.
Very good. Quite a contrast to what we might think today as crony capitalism or people that are connected with the civil government looking for deals. and privileges. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, you spend three lectures on the American Revolution, so why don't you highlight that for us?
Yeah, I do that because the American Revolution is an important event in Western civilization. The United States is a product of and part of Western civilization. It's a product of European thought, and the Europeans were aware of what was going on in the American Revolution, and there were major European powers that, in one way or another, took part in the American Revolution. So you can't leave that out. And I also decided to mention it because I wanted to contrast it with the French Revolution. And unless I talk about the American Revolution, I have nothing to contrast the French one with. So I did it for those reasons. And yeah, I spent three lessons on it because I'm really interested in it. And also because I think people have, an incomplete understanding of it. People think, they think of the American Revolution as a series of battles. And of course, yes, it's a series of battles. But why did you have the battles is the more important question. Why does it come to blows? What is the fundamental dispute going on between the colonists and the British? That's much more important. And secondly, I think people, if they do know one of the motivating factors, they think of no taxation without representation. They've got that slogan in their heads, meaning that if there is going to be a tax imposed on us, it has to be imposed by our own elected representatives. That certainly is a principle of the American Revolution, but that is a very truncated view. That is to say, it's like we're cutting off the most important aspects of it. And so what I'm trying to do is explain what the gist of it really was. And it's a couple things we would say about it. When we say no taxation without representation, that's just a subset of what was a much, much more important principle to the Americans, which really was no legislation without representation. It wasn't just taxes. It was their view was that we have our own legislatures here in the colonies. And by virtue of long customary practice, our legislatures legislate for us in all matters that are directly connected to our internal affairs. The British Parliament legislates for us in matters pertaining to foreign policy and international trade. So those are things that are outside of where we are. But everything that's inside, including taxation, is something to be decided by our own elected representatives. And the British do not have the power to interfere with that. And I go and I give all the arguments that they advanced for that position. And then secondly, the other dispute, very closely related to this one, was what is the nature of the British Constitution? This is not mentioned in almost any discussion of the American Revolution, but it was very much uppermost in their minds. The British did not have a written constitution like the U.S. would later have, and one of the reasons that we do have one is precisely that Americans lived under an unwritten constitution and decided we don't want to do that again, we're going to write it down. Under the British unwritten constitution, customary practice and tradition was the law. But the trouble was that as time went on, the British Parliament would say, well, if we say so, then it's constitutional. And the colonists said, no. The understanding is if it's traditional, if it's something you've always done, then it's constitutional. And the British Parliament would come back and say, well, if we say it's constitutional, then it is. Very hard for two sides with such radically opposed views of that constitution to reconcile their differences. And so that's really what's going on. The Americans believe that the British are violating the Constitution by interfering with their liberties. Their view is the British Constitution is longstanding tradition. Well, for a century and a half, we have governed ourselves without the British interfering. We consider that to be longstanding tradition. So it's unconstitutional. And so the British are the ones introducing all these new ideas. The Americans, by and large, did think of themselves as being conservatives in the sense that we want to continue doing things the way they've always been done. And meanwhile, the British are coming along with all their new ideas of how they're going to rule over us. We want to go back to the old ways, and the British are bringing in all these innovations.
One of the innovations in the French Revolution was the guillotine.
Yeah.
And why don't you talk about the French Revolution and then contrast it with the American Revolution?
Well, incidentally, we should remember that that was considered an advance, a humane advance over previous modes of execution because it would be swift and over with. So when getting your head chopped off is considered an advance, I guess you probably don't want me to describe some of the other ways that people lost their lives before that. But the French Revolution begins not too long after the American. We dated at 1789. And there were people who thought that it was taken from the same cloth as the American. And certainly Thomas Jefferson was one of them. And Jefferson really clung to the French Revolution long after it had become unreasonable. to continue to defend it. He finally spoke out against some of the more extreme aspects of it. But in the French Revolution, we will also see the execution of a king in early 1793, Louis XVI. The French Revolution takes root simply because there were people who believed that the institution called the Estates General, which met very, very intermittently in French history, it hadn't met for about 170 years or so when it finally met again in 1789, that it was full of inequities. That the way it was set up was there were three estates of French society. You got the nobility, the clergy, and the rest of the public. And the voting would take place by estate. So no matter how many people there were among the nobility, no matter how many people were representing the clergy or whatever, the nobility got one vote. They would vote among themselves, yes or no, and then that was their one vote. So obviously, if the clergy and the nobility vote for something, they already have two votes. It doesn't matter how the third group votes. So it was argued that this is not equitable. There were some complaints that the public had. They were invited to write down what their grievances were. But their grievances were fairly finite and limited. They were not saying the whole system needs to be totally overturned and replaced by a republic. There was nothing like that. We have to kill the king. Nothing like that. All very immediate and practical, which is usually what happens when you ask the general public. Their grievances are immediate and practical. They're almost never calling for a revolution. But a revolution is what they got. And gradually what we see is little by little, every French institution is going to be remade. The monarchy will be abolished, first limited, then abolished. There'll be a new constitution, and then they'll keep coming up with new ones several times during the 1790s. We have the church being severely weakened by all its land being expropriated, taken away from it, by oaths being imposed on the clergy, and then other things. You're not allowed to take a monastic vow. You can't take a vow to be a monk and live in a monastery. They take some of those properties. They rearrange France, instead of a series of provinces, they with all these different weird boundary lines, they arrange it as like a grid. So this, because this would be more rational, and we have to be rational. We have to use reason. So they're going to use reason to completely remake French society. And what Edmund Burke saw happening was that when you do that, you're going to run into a lot of people who like the old France. What are you going to do with those people when you are systematically remaking French society? And of course, when you get to the Reign of Terror, 1793 to 1794, well, they're introducing a new calendar where there's no Sunday anymore. It's going to be 3 10-day weeks, so you won't know what is the day of rest. It's not going to be dated from the birth of Christ. It'll be dated from the execution of the king, so it'll be an entirely secular calendar. They got rid of the names of saints from the street names. They actually guillotined statues of saints. They were closing down churches all through the country. It was an incredibly widespread assault. There were nuns who were executed because they had a rosary. I mean, it was one thing after another. Basically, the clergy of France was forced to either abjure their priesthood, that is, give up being priests, or emigrate. And tens of thousands of them did emigrate out of France. So it was very, very different from the American Revolution. I mean, yes, there were victims of the American Revolution. Some British sympathizers had to flee to Canada. People had their property taken away. But there was no attempt to completely uproot American society in the way there was in French society, and to have people be viewed as disloyal or subject to penalties if they continued to believe as people had previously believed. So it was an astonishing, world-shaking series of events that eventually settled down. Napoleon is going to restore the church more or less, although the French government will still be pretty much in charge, but he's going to get rid of this ridiculous French Revolutionary calendar and some of the more obnoxious features of the French Revolution. But what you have is the Americans, as I say, conserving the old ways of self-government. But in the French case, we want to abolish the old ways entirely. We want to completely remake France altogether.
It was a wild time. Why don't you talk about the Industrial Revolution for a minute? Because you've got two lectures on that, and thankfully that's a bloodless revolution.
It is indeed. Now, I recall in my own experience when I was in junior high school, my impression was that the Industrial Revolution is a great example of why you need government intervention. Because if you don't have it, you're going to have this terrible situation where people are living in awful living conditions, awful working conditions. They're going to be impoverished. And so we need government intervention. So that's going to be one of the angles I'm going to take when I'm talking about the Industrial Revolution, is to clarify this and talk about what really happened. In the Industrial Revolution, what we begin to see is a kind of a revolutionizing of the way goods are produced. We're gradually going to see the introduction of mechanization and of new sources of energy, so that factories can be powered. They don't have to necessarily be located by water sources anymore. We're going to see the introduction of steam power. We're going to see the railroads coming into existence. And so we're going to see a dramatic increase in the sheer quantity of stuff that can be produced, which means we're going to see a dramatic increase in the standard of living. Now, that sounds strange, because we've all seen terrible depictions of how people lived in the late 18th and early 19th centuries in Britain. And there's certainly no denying that. People did live in terrible conditions. But the real question is, how did they live before? No one ever asks that question. They just take a snapshot from the Industrial Revolution and they say, boy, this must have made people even worse off than before. But that's not a necessary conclusion. How do you know how they were before? And their lives were pretty miserable before the Industrial Revolution. In fact, when historians have actually now gone back and looked, there's been a debate over this. It was called the standard of living debate. It's over now, because basically our side of things won the debate. Even the Marxists had to admit that, yeah, okay, you're right. Obviously, not everything got worse. Yeah, you don't say. When we look at how much food people ate, how much clothing they had, how much living space they had, their life expectancy, all these criteria that we look at to determine the standard of living, they were all going up. And that is significant, when we, especially when we consider that during the early Industrial Revolution, Britain was at war for a lot of those years. It was at war in the wars of the French Revolution and in the Napoleonic Wars, and yet still, with all that capital being depleted through war and all those resources being siphoned off, we still see the standard of living increasing. So the typical way the Industrial Revolution is presented is that this was a terrible catastrophe for workers. I give some readings to show that this is not correct, that historians have looked at this more closely, and they say, to the contrary, living standards increased. It's that we just have forgotten how bad they were before.
Yes, we have. The next topic I'm going to ask you about, I hope everybody's sitting down, because I want you to talk about liberalism.
Okay. Now, when we talk about liberalism, of course, in the 19th century European sense, we do not mean Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, Lyndon Johnson, Jesse Jackson, and all those people.
No.
We don't mean that. We mean something quite different. And in fact, in Europe today, they still use the word liberalism in this more traditional sense. But in the United States, liberalism has come to have a very different meaning. So to distinguish the kind of liberalism I'm talking about, we sometimes use the term classical liberalism to set it apart from the more modern version. I spend 4 lessons talking about classical liberalism, because it is such an important set of ideas. And of course, it is the set of ideas from which the Ron Paul curriculum ultimately derives a lot of its ideas. Liberalism, which we see in all different parts of the continent and from a lot of different thinkers, John Locke would be an example of an exponent of liberalism. Frederick Bastiat, who's less well known but shouldn't be, should be even better known, is an example of liberalism, is saying something like the following. It's not saying that government is always bad, that government has no role. That's not what the classical liberals were saying. But they were saying that society seems to manage itself best when government confines itself to certain basic tasks, like maintaining order within the society and protecting the society from enemies without it. But other than that, when it comes to the economy, people can manage their affairs better without government intervention. So that's really what Adam Smith had been calling for. Now, he believed in government intervention in some ways, but he was pointing in the direction of liberalism, that we don't need government directing the economy, or, as the modern phrase goes, picking winners and losers and stuff like that, establishing monopolies. We don't need any of that. It also means religious liberty, which means people should not be bothered because of what particular religion they happen to believe in. And now, it doesn't mean that the liberals were opposed to religion itself. They were opposed to the use of force in religion. And it also meant civil liberties. You know, the people should be secure in their homes against, you know, searches in their homes and unreasonable harassment. And there should be certain legal procedures followed if they're in trouble with the law, and so on and so forth. They want to get rid of arbitrary behavior by government officials. So basically private property. They prefer peace rather than war. They prefer free trade rather than hampered trade. That was liberalism. So I devote a lesson to giving the ideas of liberalism. And then I start talking about some people. So I talk about Frederick Bastiat, for example. And then I talk about some really challenging thinkers like Herbert Spencer, who is reviled by all textbook authors. So therefore, I want to talk about him. Herbert Spencer, by and large, believed in full-blown liberal. He thinks that the older liberals weren't liberal enough. And then I talk about Gustave de Molinari in the late 19th century, who believed that government wasn't necessary for anything, that we could provide all the goods and services that government provides on our own with private business firms. We don't need the government for anything, basically, seems to be the drift of his argument. So I let students be exposed to all these different strains of liberalism. And, you know, maybe they'll find one of them attractive, maybe not, but at least they'll know what they are.
Well, that's great. And it also helps us to remember that libertarianism isn't something brand new that somebody just made up in the 1970s. It's been around a long time, and we've benefited mightily when it's practiced.
Exactly. So yeah, in the course, basically, I am tracing between the two Western Civ courses, I am implicitly tracing back the origins of what we might eventually call libertarianism. And in the previous Western Civ course, I note that there is a very, very good and challenging Aristotle scholar named Fred Miller, who's actually written now the title of the book is escaping me, unfortunately. I mentioned it in the course, but he makes an argument that even though the language of rights is not used in Aristotle, we can see in germ the beginnings of some of these ideas. So they are actually quite old. They do, in fact, go a little bit earlier than the 1970s, as it turns out.
Absolutely. And I just want to kind of do a little time out here in the middle of this, in that the parents often are learning this now. They're learning this as adults. But isn't it wonderful to have students learn this when they're teenagers so they can build their careers, build their whole political philosophy on the philosophy of freedom and true liberalism, classical liberalism.
Well, and as a matter of fact, one of the benefits of my courses in particular in the curriculum is that I include audio files in addition to the videos. So every single video on that video page will have a way to download just the audio. So you can listen to it on the go. Now, most students will be sitting there watching the presentation with the PowerPoint slides and everything. But this means that parents can listen to these during their commutes. And I hope that one thing that you've noticed during this discussion so far is that none of this is being taught at a level that would be either too difficult for a high school student or too, let's say, easy for an adult to benefit from. I've tried to strike a balance so that adults won't feel talked down to. That they'll feel like, you know, I didn't really get this material, or if I did, I don't remember it, or I certainly didn't get it taught to me this way, and these are all important topics, and I wish I knew more about them, and I feel kind of insecure that I wish I knew more. Well, then great. Then you can take this course yourself while your student is taking it.
Absolutely, and it is a rigorous course, but yet the students can take a CLEP test when they're finished and get college credit for Western civilization.
Typically, the students who are preparing for CLEP exams have been taking just a semester of Western civilization from 1493 or whatever the start date of their course would be, but this is a full-year course. So it would seem to me that you'd be likely to do – it'd be easier for you to prepare for the CLEP exam because you've studied this twice as long as any other student you'd be competing with.
Well, Tom, let's jump to World War I in the 20th century. Let's talk about that.
You know, a lot of people are more interested in talking about World War II because it's, you know, it seems so interesting, and from a military point of view, people are get absorbed by it, and it's on TV a lot. And of course, no one's going to deny the influence of World War II on the world we live in. But World War I sets a stage for so much in so many ways, and of course, it sets the stage for World War II itself. So I spend. In fact, let me take a look here. I've got five lessons on World War I, including the Paris Peace Conference. So that's a little bit more than a week because I also have a review lesson. So here I talk about exactly how it is that World War I came about, and that has been disputed for a century. People, whereas with World War II, people feel like they've got a pretty good grip on who started what and how it got going. But World War I, almost immediately after the war was over, we got a school of historians known as revisionist historians who went back and tried to reassess the war guilt question. Who was ultimately most guilty of being responsible for the outbreak of the war? And the Treaty of Versailles, which ended the war with Germany, had insisted that Germany bore exclusive blame for the outbreak of the war. And the Germans protested this. They argued that they wouldn't deny they had some role in it, but the idea that nobody else had a role whatsoever in the outbreak of the war seemed like the kind of thing you would read in a dictated peace treaty. I mean, let's be realistic. So there were revisionist historians who argued that there were some, like Harry Elmer Barnes, who argued that of all the countries involved, Germany was the least responsible. Then in the 1960s, you got a historian named Fritz Fischer, and he went back and said, no, the Germans were looking for an excuse to expand their territory. They were anxious to goad their allies into war, and so no, they didn't. They are very much responsible. Then there's the post-Fischer thesis to say, well, Fischer overstated. So this has been very confusing, so I do try and sort that out for people in talking about it. But so many aspects of the modern world in terms of warfare come into play here. I mean, we've got the machine gun, the tank, poison gas, for example, which was used on both sides. A lot of this stuff starts in World War I. The very term basket case that we use, we say somebody's a basket case, dates back to World War I, when a basket case was a quadruple amputee, which gives you a sense of the scale and scope of the injuries that people were suffering. The casualties in the war were staggering, like anything that had ever been seen before. So we look at that. We look at the United States' role as well, that the war was very much grinding down into a stalemate. With there might have been a slight edge for the Germans, but the Germans were really having trouble feeding themselves at that point, because the British had established a hunger blockade that was making it impossible even for ships leaving neutral ports to be able to ship food that would be able to reach the German population. So you had a situation where the German public, people were going around looking in garbage cans for food, or their subsistence was potatoes and turnips, and then in the so-called turnip winter, the potato crop failed, and all they had was turnips. So we have large-scale assaults on whole populations in that way, that by some estimates, 750,000 people were died as a result of malnourishment during the war. So a lot of what we think of today as total war was taking place during World War I. And then, of course, there's the nationalism at the heart of it. There were people who cheered as the soldiers went off to war. Now, some historians have said this is exaggerated, if you look in the countryside in these countries, there was much less enthusiasm for the war. But in the cities, you have these big populations who get riled up by nationalist fervor, and they say this is going to be great. Everybody will be – this is the summer of 1914. Everybody will be home by the winter, by Christmas time, and they're not. They're just getting ground up in the trenches just year after year, fighting battles that wind up moving the front just a matter of yards, people dying for this purpose. And once it's all over, you get a whole new map of Europe. You get the Austro-Hungarian Empire divided up into much smaller states. These states are organized supposedly on the principle of self-determination, but in fact, it just winds up creating more minorities in these smaller states. And they wind up with the German minority in Czechoslovakia protesting that they are being discriminated against. Even Czechoslovakia is not uniformly Czech, so you wind up with all these other minority problems, and you wind up with some of these smaller states being practically tailor-made for a Hitler to come in and take them over. So a lot of disastrous consequences of World War I. It was thought that this would be the war to end all wars, but most historians today say that to the contrary, it simply paved the way for a resentful Germany that feels like it was tricked. It was told that the peace terms would be thus and so by Woodrow Wilson, and it wound up getting very harsh peace terms. This Germany is going to eventually realize that it's not, can't be expected to be a second-class citizen in Europe forever. They're going to be bitter about this, and therefore sitting ducks for the likes of a nationalist like Hitler to take over.
Wow. Well, there's another nationalist in Russia, and I'm talking about Lenin and other Marxists with the Russian Revolution. And on the TomWoods.com show about a month ago, you played an episode from one of your courses on the Ron Paul curriculum that highlighted the two Russian revolutions of 1917. Why don't you summarize that for us? Because I think that'll be interesting to our listeners.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. In fact, yeah, for that, I have actually played a couple of my lessons as episodes on my show. For that episode, I actually just just extemporaneously spoke about the Russian Revolution. But I said, this is inspired by my course. So if you like this one thing, you're going to like the whole course. So I just did sort of a riff on it. But I find the Russian Revolution to be one of the most interesting episodes ever. I devote a whole week to it in this course, Western Civilization from 1493. Yeah, the two Russian revolutions are as follows. People think of the Russian Revolution, they think of the communists taking over. And I think some people think that the communists got rid of the czars. First you had the czars, then you had the communists. But that's not true. There was an interim government in between. The first of the Russian revolutions consisted of the czar's abdication, the czar Nicholas II, for basically patriotic reasons, abdicated when he was told that really there was no way to hold on unless you just want to mow everybody down, and he didn't. So he abdicates and is replaced by what was known as the provisional government. And you did have some sort of liberals in the provisional government, but they wanted to carry on fighting World War I, and this became a bit of a problem. Now, the traditional telling is that World War I by this point was so unpopular that this was a real disability for the provisional government. But it hadn't yet become that unpopular. And this wasn't the big selling point that it would later become for the communists. But as the year wore on and the war just continued to drag on and the conditions got bad, people did begin to sour on this a bit. And the Bolsheviks, which is a wing of the communists, did begin to be able to use this and exploit this issue against the provisional government. The main issue that the communists pushed against the provisional government was it kept saying we're going to hold elections for an assembly, a legislative body. But Lenin, the communist leader, was telling everybody they're never going to hold those elections. They're snowing you. They're never going to hold those elections. You shouldn't trust these people. What we need is, and then he had these, it's called the July Theses, and it was all these sorts of demands that we have. And of course, the communists want, they don't want to try to make the existing system better. They want to overturn the existing system altogether. What they want is, in the communist revolution, they want no more private property in the means of production. So that means whatever, it's factories, capital equipment, banks, railroads, whatever. No private ownership of those things. The state will own those things, and eventually the state will wither away, although, curiously, that never seemed to happen in any. When they eventually do take power, they do so at the end of 1917. And I explain all the details of how this small minority, and they were a small minority, is able to basically take power from a really disillusioned and demoralized provisional government. But even though they're a small minority, they are able to consolidate their position. They're able to carry out, a reign of terror in Russia against class enemies, against perceived enemies of their new regime. They try to run the economy without cash. They try to run the economy with basically communists running the factories. And this grinds to an incredible halt. I've got all the statistics in these lessons of industrial production falling through the floor under the Russians. We've got a famine with millions of people suffering as a result of the Russian communists. Just one issue after another. They try to blame all this on the civil war that broke out after they took power, but that clearly cannot account for what we see going on. The communist government turns on the peasants and says the peasants are hoarding grain. We've got to go into the countryside and confiscate the grain. The peasants aren't going to go along with this, so now you've got a major war going on in the countryside. Meanwhile, you have Russian generals trying to seize power from the communists. It's just an absolute fiasco. The economy's collapsing. The standard of living is collapsing. They can't feed the workers. they have to eventually take a step back and temporarily allow some kind of market economy. Very interesting. They realize that the only way not for everyone not to starve to death is to restore the market economy. But everything has to be destroyed. They have an assault on religion. They have an assault on the traditional economy, all the traditional owners. They have an assault on Russian culture. Instead of traditional music, they want to introduce proletarian, that is, workers' music. Well, what would workers' music be like? Well, it would be the workers taking all the tools they use to work. And since the workers are the great force of communism, supposedly, they are the dominant class in history that are going to finally bring communism into existence, let's take all their instruments. So let's take the and I don't mean musical instruments, I mean instruments for work. Let's take the factory whistles and the hammers and the, you know, the fog horns, and we'll make orchestras out of those, and we'll write symphonies for these things. And it's just noise, right? It's just totally crazy. I think on YouTube you can actually get an example of this. It's total lunacy, right? I mean, it's like the lunatics have taken over in Russia at that point. That's so it's like the French Revolution, where they're remaking all of French society. They very much consciously modeled themselves after that, but multiply it by 100. And meanwhile, the rule of law suffers because Lenin says, well, we don't need any of the existing legal codes. What we need are judges who don't necessarily have any legal training, but who simply have a revolutionary consciousness. They can look at each case by case as it emerges, and decide according to a good revolutionary consciousness how the case should be decided. So you don't know what's going to happen. There's no way you can predict how any of these judges will rule. And then meanwhile, the churches are being looted and plundered because the regime is out of money, so they have to seize all the valuables from the churches so they can melt them down and sell them to get money to do whatever crazy thing they want to try next. It's horrifying, and yet Lenin turns out to be not the worst guy in the history of this thing. That'll be his successor, Stalin. But I at least get you started by talking about the period from 1917 to 1924.
Yeah, what a wild time, and I'm just very thankful that our revolution wasn't like their revolution. It wasn't like the French Revolution. But why don't we jump forward to 1991, specifically December 26, which really ought to be a day drilled into our consciousness as really the first time in history that an empire collapsed without bloodshed. Why don't you tell us about that and what happened?
Yeah, okay. In fact, I lived through this, right? This is an interesting thing that you and I lived through this, didn't we? And I didn't live through any of these other things. Anything that we've talked about in these two episodes, I didn't live through any of it. But I watched this on my TV. Now, my kids didn't. So I get to show this to them, and for them, it's like a history lesson. But for me, it's like it happened just yesterday. I can find footage on YouTube from news reports of what was happening in Eastern Europe, because as you'll see as my course goes along, of course, the adults listening will know the rough outline of what happened, but the Soviet Union, which was what Soviet Russia, the version of it that took shape under the communists was called, as time goes on, it comes to dominate the countries of Eastern Europe to one degree or another. And these Eastern European countries were in one way or another tethered to the Soviet Union in their internal policy. And they came to resent this because these societies were desperately poor and miserable. And they could see that the Western world did not live the way they lived. And why is that? Why should they have to live in this miserable way? The East Germans wanted to know about that. The Hungarians wanted answers to that question. The Romanians wanted answers to that question. And with the exception of Romania, where there was some violence, and they did actually execute Nicolae Ceausescu, who had been their leader for many, many years, had an eerie resemblance to Dracula, by the way. So sometimes people really do look like the people they morally resemble. We got, and it is interesting to watch. I showed a documentary on Ceausescu to some of my kids. It's interesting to get to see some of this footage. But basically what began to happen during the 80s, you had some stirrings of revolt in Poland beginning in the early 1980s. And then as the 80s wore on, there's more and more unrest as conditions began to worsen and worsen. And you got this guy in the Soviet Union, Mikhail Gorbachev, who seemed to be indicating that he would not, in fact, carry out the Brezhnev Doctrine, which basically said that if any one of the satellite countries of the Soviet Union, like Hungary, should try to break free, we will come in there and crush it. He gave the hint that maybe he wouldn't. And then there was a movement in Germany to lift the restrictions on travel. Because, of course, there was a Berlin Wall. You couldn't cross the Berlin Wall between East and West Berlin. And they were going to open it and see what would happen. But somehow they got their signals crossed. So the guy on television who was being questioned by the press, well, do you mean that this new policy takes effect immediately? And he looked through his papers and he said, I guess so. Well, it had been intended to take effect the following day, as it turns out. So the border guards are not prepared for what is about to hit them, as an enormous number of people now go to test this out. Can we actually cross over into the West? And the guards didn't know what was going on. They were pushing back. And finally, they just said, all right, walk right through. And things were never the same after that. You're not going to put that toothpaste back into the tube. We've got demonstrations in one country after another, hundreds of thousands of people coming out and saying, we're simply not going to obey orders anymore. And when that happens, hundreds of thousands of people, things do really change. Now, Ceausescu tried to hold on as if nothing was happening. He still expects to be able to walk out on the balcony of the palace and be cheered by everybody. But instead, he was being jeered. And he had to flee, and there was pursuit, and there was fighting in the streets. But ultimately, all these regimes will be toppled. Every single one of them is going to fall. And nobody really saw this coming. Nobody predicted that. Everybody assumed that the grip that the Soviet Union had on them was so tight that it could never be undone. And yet, the totally unexpected happened, and it was astonishing to the world, astonishing to me, and a source of such joy and pleasure for everybody to see that these people, who had been treated like garbage by these regimes for so many years, maybe now had the prospect of living a life worthy of a human being dangled before them.
Absolutely. It's mind-boggling to even comprehend the fact that when people wanted to go from East Germany to West Germany, that the border guards would shoot to kill.
Yeah, there were a number of people who did die in the history of the Berlin Wall. And, you know, it's interesting, even before they got the Berlin Wall up, they'd first put a lot of barbed wire along that area. And the problem was people were willing to tear themselves to shreds in order to get to the other side. So barbed wire was not good enough. And then there would be, along the area of the wall, there were apartment buildings that were right on the border. And this was also a problem because there were windows in these apartment buildings. So you could enter that building from windows on the east and then come onto the other side and jump out a window into the west. And that we actually have footage of people doing this. And they would signal with light signals to the other side. They would say, I'm going to be jumping from the second floor window, third window over at such and such time. So could you please have a net there for me? And we've even got footage of an old woman trying to do this. And there are Eastern European police trying to pull her back in. I beg your pardon, East Berlin police trying to pull her back into the building while there are Westerners trying to pull her down. They finally do get her. And then at the end of that footage, you see that they, on the Eastern side, they've bricked up all those windows so that nobody can do that anymore.
It's just amazing. Well, it's a wonderful example of going from totalitarianism to freedom. And it happened in our lifetime. The Soviet Union was a giant, you know, federal level government with 30, 40,000 nuclear weapons. And they turned the keys to all those weapons over to Russia. And the Russian people did get freedom, not complete freedom, but they sure got a whole lot more than they used to have. Just ask you a question in closing. This has been a great interview. You've covered a lot of ground. I hope we've encouraged people that it's never too late to learn Western civilization, and it's just a great way for homeschooling parents to teach their kids about Western civilization and prepare them for passing CLEP exams. But I want to have you speak to the libertarians out there that are listening to this episode, maybe attracted to it because of you, most likely. And they're not homeschooling their kids. Their kids aren't in private schools. Maybe they're in public schools or charter schools. But I'd really like you to speak to them, give them a call to action or some things to think about, that if they want to limit the state long term, the education of their own children has got to be a part of that.
Well, I guess I would invite them to think about what the world would be like if, you know, even 15% of the up-and-coming generation had been exposed to the ideas that they care about. And I know that a lot of these people will say, I didn't know any of this stuff, and then I started reading it, and I couldn't stop. And I just love it, and I look at the world differently now, and I wish everybody could have a chance to be exposed to this. And again, it doesn't mean that you don't get exposed to any competing ideas. But the point is, in the traditional setting, you do not get these ideas at all, even though they are part of history. The classical liberalism is a part of history. You know, they'll gloss over it, and that'll be the end of it. There's only one side that's shown. What if we had 15% of people who had seen both sides, who had the opportunity that you've had to have your eyes opened and so on and so forth? I mean, imagine what the consequences would be. The world would be a different place. Well, where does that start? It starts in our own homes. Now, of course, my kids have a different situation because, you know, they get to hear me talk about historical topics at the dinner table. You know, they can't escape it even if they wanted to. Not everybody is that way. And this program is a tremendous opportunity for you to make sure that some people, some young people, don't have to look around vainly for these sorts of ideas, to look for ideas of liberty. They can have a fighting chance to learn about them as young people. And so then they can begin building on what they know all the earlier. And they will be way ahead when they're my age. They'll be way ahead of where I am now because they had this starting point. So it's true that homeschooling is not necessarily for everyone. That's fair enough. But it is for some people. And I bet you know somebody in your life who would be interested in this, not only because it spreads these ideas and gives people a chance to study them, but it also gives parents mental health back to them. A lot of times homeschooling can be so demanding that parents just don't know how they can possibly manage it. How am I going to keep my house clean and keep an eye on my little kids and do lesson plans, whatever? You don't have to do any more lesson plans. No more. Not a single lesson plan as long as you live. The Ron Paul curriculum just runs itself. So I would say to other libertarians, I bet you at least know some homeschoolers, and I bet those homeschoolers are feeling like they just can't hold it together. It's really, really hard. Take some of that burden off them by telling them about the Ron Paul curriculum, and you will get friends who have more time to see you and who are in better mental health. You'll get more children who have a fighting chance to learn the ideas that were basically hidden from us and that just by sheer luck we happened to stumble upon. Give them a chance to not just stumble upon it, but have it presented to them in an instructional way. And who knows what the results will be.
That's great, Tom. I really hope they take that to heart and, you know, head on over to ronpaulhomeschooling.com. They can look at a list of all the courses, and maybe they just want to cherry pick a couple courses like Western Civilization to have as an after-school educational course. They will learn everything they need to know about Western Civ, and they'll also be prepared to take a college CLEP exam and get double duty for that extra credit. And as you say, it'll lay a foundation for their future that they won't regret, and they'll get a head start on all the rest of us. That sounds great. Tom, do you have any other closing words you'd like to speak out to our audience before we head out?
Well, first of all, you should listen to every single episode of the Ron Paul Homeschooling Podcast. I intend to do that because I want to know more about what the other faculty members are doing. I'm very interested in this. I know some of it, and everything I know is fantastic. So I want to see, does this level of quality hold up across it? I think it does. Given how much I know about the people involved, I'm just really excited about it. But I would say, well, one thing I'd like is if people gave my own podcast a chance. I have, as you mentioned, I release an episode Monday through Friday, and I'm basically taking Ron Paul's ideas and applying them to current events or to historical events or the economy or whatever. And every single day, I release another episode. So the tagline at the end of the episode is, become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. So you can find out more about that over at tomwoods.com.
Well, that's a great idea. And I do it in 20 minutes, Tom, because I listen at 1.5 speed. Yeah, it's great. It's a wonderful show. I really highly recommend it.
But I have some guests you couldn't do 1.5 speed with. I'd like to see you try it with Brian Kaplan, who did the episode on... he has a book coming out called The Case Against Education, and it's tongue-in-cheek. He just means that too many people are going to college for no good reason. But he's the fastest speaker I've ever heard. I think you need to slow him down to 0.5 to be able to get that.
Well, you know, I didn't go that far, but I did go to 1x speed when I listened to that episode.
Right.
I do remember that episode. And again, it brings out another strength of the Ron Paul curriculum. The students are going to go to middle school. They're going to go to high school. Why not have a rigorous middle school and a rigorous high school so that if you end up starting a business or doing something that doesn't take you to college, you'll still have effectively a great college education?
That is an excellent point. Because that's exactly what you will have. That is an excellent point.
Absolutely. Okay, all you out there, you've listened today. Just encourage you to listen to Tom, to go through to the show notes page, listen to lesson number one. You'll see and hear him in action, and I hope it motivates you to sign up at ronpaulhomeschooling.com for the Ron Paul curriculum. You won't regret it, and you really will learn a lot yourself. So again, Tom, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
All right, that's episode 505. Remember, if you're planning on joining the Ron Paul curriculum, join it through ronpaulhomeschool.com, because that's where I give you $140 worth of free bonuses. And do check out the whole podcast dedicated to the Ron Paul curriculum. That's ronpaulhomeschooling.com, if you can keep that straight in your head. Episode 506 tomorrow. We'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.